You are listening to Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis. I am Peter Nittler, the college pastor of First Baptist Church in Davis, California. And our mission is to shape college age people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And on this podcast, we want to have conversations that will accompany our Tuesday night Zoom gatherings. And we hope that they form you, encourage you, maybe even make you laugh, and that they would be a source of King Jesus guiding you through this time. So have you ever noticed that there's some things in life that people care either way too much about or way too little about? Like take dental hygiene, for example. You can just look at my twisted life as an example. Like I care so much about flossing and brushing my teeth that I'll do it when there are people in my house. I'll do it on a Zoom call at night. And I think some people would say, that's rude. You care a little too much. But you pair that with the fact that I haven't been to the dentist in 3 years. And so on one hand, I care way too much. On the other hand, I don't care nearly enough. And I'm about to say a big word, but I think that eschatology is the same way. And eschatology is the theological bucket of ideas that deals with the end times. And so when it comes to eschatology or end times, capital E, capital T, it seems like we tend to care either way too much. You know, people are predicting the day, they're allegorizing literally everything to be symbols of the coming end, or we don't care nearly enough. Maybe thinking that it's just a kooky idea. It has no real bearing on how we live our lives. And so this week, Stanford and I open up Paul's letter to the Thessalonians, and this end time stuff sort of jumps off the page. So we talk about it. What is Paul trying to say in these strange passages? And what bearing should it have on the lives of the Thessalonians or our lives now? And of course, there's always more to talk about too. There's some compelling passages about the will of God. There's a gut punch of a passage on sexual ethics. And there's some profound thoughts on something even as banal as work. And so we talk about all of that. So connect with us at collegelifedavis.com or on the College Life Davis app to see what we're doing and how to find your place. But I really loved this conversation, and I hope you will too. Enjoy the pod. All right, everybody, welcome back to Your Pod and Your Staff. I am Peter Nittler, of course. You recognize my voice. And I am with my good friend, Stanford Gibson. What's going on, man?
Hey, Peter.
You know, I am recording from my office at First Baptist Church, Davis, California. It's a little bit different today because yesterday, we're recording on a Wednesday. Yesterday, got a text from the big man, Steve Luxa, saying that we had a break-in at FBC. And
you were ransacked.
We were ransacked. So show up and the sheriff's office is here. And, you know, they usher me in to see what was taken from my office. And we were planning this podcast when I got the text. And so what was our first thought, Stanford?
Your podcast equipment.
Yeah, I was like, oh, no, take anything you want. Just not the podcast equipment. And so I show up to the office and some petty cash is gone. A few gift cards are gone. But podcast equipment was safe. So I think that was deemed unworthy to sell on the black market.
We've been broken into a couple of times. Once when we lived in West Sac.
Yeah.
And I remember the place was just ransacked. It really does look like a movie because they just tore everything all over the place. And the funny thing is they only took our change, but we had just moved from Buffalo. We had a jar of coins that actually had a lot of like Canadian money in it because that's what happens when you live on the border. They had actually dumped the change and left the Canadian money. the funniest thing that the thieves did in our house is they're just like, you know what? We'll take anything, but just not Canadian tender.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny because I agree. It's like everything was just thrown all over the place. And it looks like, just like you said, it looks like a movie. And I don't know what I was expecting. I guess I was expecting like, maybe you don't want to cause a scene. But I guess if you're already breaking in, who cares? You know,
the thing I learned is that people hide money in books and in their ice chest. And so like all of the books were on the floor and like ice was all over our floor. I was like, why the ice? It's like, apparently that's where people hide money.
Yeah. Well, we are diving into Thessalonians this morning and we are closing the book on the book of James and diving into Thessalonians this morning, which means that we are entering into and venturing into the world of Paul, the Apostle Paul, which I have to say, I was driving in this morning and I always like to think about sort of my mood before the conversation, like how excited am I? How nervous am I? Whatever it is. And I was thinking, man, Paul is a load. Paul is great and wonderful. But sometimes I think when I'm reading Paul, because he's a Christian leader and I'm a Christian leader, and I think, man, we could not be more different, him and me. Sometimes I feel that way. And if being like him was a prerequisite for sort of professional Christian work, then I need to find a new line of work. Reading him, he sometimes he says things so strongly. He has just unwavering passion. And tons of things we could say about Paul, but we're entering into his world now. And it's a little bit different world than James, huh?
Yeah, I think Paul is like the friend that you know you need to have. You have this kind of portfolio of friends, and some of them are really like you. And so you end up like, you know, amplifying the things about you that are both good and not so good. And then you have these other friends that are very different than you. That's one of the things the church does, is some forced mixing so that not all of your friends are like you. And you like, you don't always look forward to hanging out with them because they're so intense. But after you've hung out with them, you're like, oh, wow, that was really good. That was really helpful. I'm not maybe looking forward to doing that again next weekend, but definitely next month. I have a couple of people like that in my life. It's always good to spend time with them, and they always push me, but you know, small doses.
Right. The best man at my wedding, other than my brother, he's like that. He's the only person. He's really the only person that I actually argue with. You know, we actually get into arguments about what we think about like the scriptures and stuff. Like the only person really in my life.
Right.
And so, yeah, sometimes we're on the phone. I'm like, oh, gosh, I don't want to argue. I just want to like talk. But then I'm so glad that I have him. You know, I wouldn't trade him for anything. So that's who Paul is.
Yep.
So tell me, you are our resident Thessalonian thinker right now, which is not necessarily true. You know, we both read Thessalonians, but you've just maybe read it two more times or something like that. But what were your impressions before we even get into context? What are your impressions reading the letters to the Thessalonians?
Well, I mean, after just talking about how Paul is kind of like, you know, tough-minded, no nonsense, whatever.
Right.
He's super emotional in this book.
Totally.
There's a lot of like mushy love stuff in here. I think that one of the reasons I like Paul, one of the things that draws me to Paul is that he's really tough-minded. Mm-hmm. He is no nonsense, and he's like a very careful, precise thinker. But like, he's also a passionate guy. He also really just has like genuine affection for people.
Right.
So the first half of the book, I was just struck again about just really the affectionate tone. And I think a lot of times we talk about love as if it's this like pull yourself up by your bootstraps and love the church, whether they're lovable or not sort of thing.
Yeah, right.
That's not what Paul's doing here. Paul is like actually cultivating affection. And I think that's actual love. I mean, if you're going to be in a marriage for decades, you need to cultivate affection.
Right.
That is a skill. Like, I think we're coming close to 20 years at FBC. And, you know, if you're going to be at a, like, let's not use the word imperfect, because imperfect is not the right word. If you're going to be in a deeply flawed human institution, and that's nothing against FBC, it's a human institution. Human institutions are deeply flawed. If you're going to grow and benefit from that for 20 years, then you're going to cultivate affection. And so I just think that Paul is setting the framework for what it means to be part of a church that is a wonderful institution, but also a place that you're going to need to find peace and love. But then the second half of the book, it's pretty wild, right?
Yeah. I was going to say, I think that there's two things that as I'm reading the scriptures sort of fast that I tend to forget. So as I'm reading, it's like, I don't remember these two things. One is sort of the affectionate language, because I think that I've been trained to view these letters as just theological treaties. And so the affectionate stuff, I'm like, okay, who cares? Let's get to the ideas. So it's like, that doesn't register. Or sometimes when you're reading quickly, it doesn't register. And then also things that you don't understand or don't like very much don't register. And that's sort of the two sides of this book, you know? So I think I came to Thessalonians, even though I've read it a bunch of times, like with sort of a blank slate of like, I don't really have opinions on Thessalonians going into this, because it's so much of the affectionate stuff. And then it's all this weird imagery of the rapture and us flying to heaven and judgment sometimes. And so it's like, I don't even know where to start. And so I don't remember. Mm-hmm. Like both sides of these things made me think, I don't really know much. I don't really have many thoughts on the Thessalonians going in. And right now, you know, diving into it, I feel like I have more thoughts that I'm excited to talk about.
For sure. Yeah. It's not one of my go-to books, right? I think that like of the Pauline letters, Colossians is really my favorite. And, you know, Philippians is everyone's favorite. So after Philippians, Colossians. And then like the Romans is challenging. I think 2 Corinthians is the Jeremiah of the New Testament. So I'm just drawn to it because it's like super personal and kind of unveils Paul's like weaker side. So like those are the books that I tend to be drawn to. But, you know, I think a practice of reading the books you're not drawn to, yeah. It unveils stuff.
Well, and you might be not drawn to it because during one season, it didn't click or something like that. During one season, it was less important. But these are not texts for just one season. You know, these are texts that we're supposed to be dealing with for our whole time with Jesus, you know? And so it makes sense that something that wasn't awesome last time you read it might be awesome this time you read it, you know?
Coming on a third decade of Christian life, it is remarkable to me how dynamic these texts are
right. As
I read them. And I'm just a totally different person. And I just realized,
Oh, wow,
I didn't actually get that 20 years ago. Either I just didn't understand the principle or like the words, or I didn't understand why it was important to like the human experience because I hadn't had that human experience yet.
Right. Well, it's interesting. You know, I don't know if we're going to get to this. This is just a little example. But like, I think previous times that I've read Thessalonians, I haven't been aware that it's Paul writing it or even just all the letters. Like I was less aware of authorship.
Yeah.
And so there's this passage in this one where Paul is talking about how when he was with the Thessalonians, he had no mixed motives. He had no ulterior motives. He was basically just totally pure of heart. And now I'm sitting here as a pastor and I'm thinking, Paul, how in the world do you know that your motives are that pure? How can you possibly know that? And if you do, I'm amazed and I would love to know what that's like because everything seems to have a mixed motives. Everything seems to be gray. And yet this guy's talking like he's in total control of his emotions and motives for doing anything at any time. And, you know, that's not necessarily an insight that I'm saying right now, but it's like, that's certainly something that popped to me and it didn't pop before. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a different level of confidence. And again, that's just part of the lovely diversity of the church. One of the authors that we both enjoy, Bill Simmons, he talks about some basketballs are irrational confidence guys. They'll take the shot whether they should or not. And like, you just need some of those guys on your team. You need some guys who are just going to take the shot and just feel pretty good about what they're doing, you know? And then, you know, there are other people who maybe are more introspective, maybe too introspective so that they don't actually do stuff.
Right.
I like to think that, you know, the Timothy and Tituses, Silas's, Barnabas's on Paul's team were the ones that were like, oh, that's a great idea, Paul. Maybe we could do something else.
Yeah,
what do you think about this, Paul? You know, like, and
he was
the visionary that charged ahead, but you can tell that he surrounds himself with people and like actually gender diverse teams too. Like there are a lot of women on Paul's teams. Traveling as a woman in the ancient world was tough. But when you look at the churches he plants, like he's pretty aware of building teams that are going to see the whole picture.
Yeah. Well, let's dive into the context. We hope to give just a little bit of context for each of these letters in a way that is helpful and not boring. There's sometimes a way where you go and look for context and then you get all this information that you that's like, I don't even know what that word means. I don't even know who that is. Like I need more context for the context. And so our hope is that we give some context for these letters that actually help us understand it a little bit more. And so Stanford, do you have anything to help us? Anything going on in Thessalonian church or life of Paul?
Well, I mean, there's one sense in which the Bible provides some context, right? Like if you're in the prophets, it almost always tells you who's king during that time. And so you just flip back to Kings and Chronicles and read about that king and you get the context. And with the epistles, it's the same. You know, the book of Acts is the narrative of what's going on at this time. Acts is the sequel to Luke. And so we actually have a historical narrative at this time. In chapter 17, we hear about Paul's visit to Thessalonica. And Paul's visit to Thessalonica, he just really enjoys them. He found people that became the church there. It's no wonder that he's writing with such affection because he seems to really enjoy that. But it does not go well.
No.
The civic leaders there understand that he's preaching, you know, something that's politically subversive. And there's a Hamilton quote right there in your Bible. It's the first of two that we're going to find. These are the people that are turning the world upside down.
Yeah.
And so they end up actually running Paul and Silas out of town. There's riots. Like a guy's home is burned. Like it's not a good scene. And so, you know, basically Paul leaves this church behind. They've basically just kind of heard the gospel, said, hey, that sounds amazing, and become a church. Paul starts both of his letters to the church in Thessalonica. So they're a church. They're a local church, except Paul didn't get to like help them grow at all. He immediately had to get out of town. And so he's writing this back to them. The aftermath of the riots are probably not great. The decision they've made to start a church in Thessalonica is politically unpopular and probably has some like real physical and vocational and political ramifications for them.
You know, you think about when things get unpopular, when you're going through big, big, big trials, it sort of makes more sense for people who have been Yahweh followers, at the very least, you know, people who have grown up with the Jewish tradition, which, you know, Jesus is fulfilling. But it feels like another thing entirely for this to be brand new information for some Gentile people who then Paul has talked to and now they're following Jesus. Seems like those people, you know, they just got on the freeway. If they're like, hey, this freeway sucks, you know, this freeway, let's get on a different one. Like, it's a pretty quick exit for them. Whereas, if, you know, in the left lane, you've been cruising on this freeway for a long time, you know, you're a Jewish follower of Jesus, Messianic Jew, then it's a bigger deal to get off. Like, if I were Paul and there's these brand new believers who have not been following Yahweh this whole time, and then they start going through trials, you know, pessimistic me, I should say pessimistic Pete, more alliterative. I'm assuming these people are done. Like, there's no way they last. Like,
this isn't going to work.
Yeah.
Especially because this is his first letter, right? This is the first letter we have from Paul. And so there's this sense in which he's almost surprised that the church is even happening. There's a sense that, oh, maybe I'm not the one doing this, right? Like, because Paul has different strategies in different towns. And like, when he went to Ephesus, he stayed in Ephesus for 3 years.
Right.
Every day he spent helping train those folks in the new life. And so there's this sense in which, you know, he just leaves this like fledgling church in Thessalonica. And like you said, you know, in different places, like the makeup of the new church is partially people who were coming from the Jewish tradition and see as the fulfillment of tradition. And then those who are just, you know, part of the various Roman religions, they're just like, oh no, you know, actually I'm going to follow Yahweh and the fulfillment in Jesus and like cross 8 lanes of traffic to get there,
right?
To take that exit. And the idea that this church is primarily made up of those folks who crossed 8 lanes of traffic are starting something totally new. And then he didn't get to stay with them. I think that he's just delighted that it's obviously the work of something beyond him.
Oh, yeah.
You get that tone throughout the letter.
Totally, totally. And I was thinking about this is so much less stakes, but like say that I went on a long sabbatical, like say I was gone for 2 years from college life. And maybe I intentionally said, I'm going to cut myself off entirely. You know, it's like if I need to fully rest or something like that, like I don't want to hear anything about college life. And then a year and a half in, someone sends me a letter and says, hey, just so you know, like college life is thriving, you know, and it's like a couple things. Like one, there's not even necessarily the persecution that this church is dealing with. And I am under no impression that I am holding this community together. Sometimes maybe I think I am, but like I'm under no actual impression that I'm holding this community together. But still, I would be thrilled beyond thrilled because it wouldn't shock me if any leader leaving that something sort of fizzles, you know?
Yeah,
and so I would just be so overjoyed. And so imagining Paul is really cool. It seems like that's why the affectionate language makes so much sense because I imagine there's just like this combination of surprise and elation. And I wonder if it's fueling his faith. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, this story that I'm living out has the power to change these people's lives. And if that's fueling him all the more. Because, you know, it's interesting when you just read the text, you do get context clues. Like even you get context clues for Paul's life. In chapter 2, he's talking to the Thessalonians and he's saying, you know, we had already suffered and been shamefully treated at Philippi when we had come to you. And so Paul's coming off of a loss, essentially. He's coming off of another, not necessarily a loss because the church didn't go well, but like he suffered and was shamefully treated. And so if I'm imagining, again, putting myself in his shoes, if I am leaving Philippi after sort of being kicked out and being suffered and shamefully treated, then I'm coming to this next town of Thessalonica, like my confidence must be shaken a little bit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, you don't get the sense that his is. Like he said that we had boldness in our God to declare to you the gospel of God in the midst of much conflict. It's amazing to me. Like he's coming off getting crushed and he's willing to go to the next town and try it again.
Yeah. You know, I had an experience like this early on. I graduated a semester early. And so I had this like dead semester between undergrad and graduate school. And so I ended up going to the Himalayas because I thought that sounded cool. I volunteered at an orphanage in Kathmandu, but I also did a bunch of like hiking in the Himalayas. And I remember one time I was on the Annapurna route and I was having lunch at this place that, you know, they have these little tea houses that set up for people who are doing that hike. I just started chatting with the folks there and it came up that they had recently become Christians. They invited me to church that night and we were in this church at the bottom of the barn. And it's like, it turns out that one of them had gotten a hold of some Christian materials and read it and told the rest of the village about it. And like 12 of them had decided, yeah, that sounds good. I think that's right.
That's amazing.
And they just started meeting. And they just started meeting and they had gotten a hold of a couple of Bibles. And the one of them that told the rest of them about this like pamphlet he read, he was the pastor. So he would just like read out of the Bible. And I was just really encouraged that the church and, you know, community and human interactions are God's primary vehicle for building up the faith. It's just encouraging to see when God takes things into God's own hands, you know, when those things aren't available. I get the feeling that's what Paul is feeling here. He's like, well, this should not have worked. There's no kind of human explanation for this. I'm thankful for you. I'm thankful for you but I'm also thankful for you for me.
Right. So what we want to do in these conversations about the epistles to give it some shape and to try and do both these things well, to try and be affectionate with these texts because we love them and love talking about them, but also honest because there's some parts that are confusing or hard or whatever it is. And so to try and sort of do both of that, we are splitting these conversations into different segments, having some fun with it. And so it's time for our first segment. Our first segment is, excuse me, what? That's what it is. It's, excuse me, what? And this segment is sort of the thing that when you're reading, you just do a double take. Maybe it's brought to us by Doublemint Gum for the double take. That's our sponsor for this segment. So yeah, anything that as you're reading, you just sort of shake your head like, what's being said here? And so it could be hard or it could just be confusing. So Stanford, did you have any excuse me what moments?
I did. And actually, these would be great things to bring to Zoom and Consume, the little conversation that we have the Tuesday after. If you're reading these books and just say, excuse me, what?
Yeah, what is this?
Like, that's why we do that. Because there are these things that, you know, a lot of times it's just like, you know, cultural context and it clears things right up. Then other times it's like, I don't know either. Yeah. But the thing that caught me is a thing that I've talked about in college life before. And this is what the Tuesday night talk was about as well. Let's just talk about it a little bit more. Paul's treatment of the will of God. All right. So the will of God shows up twice in this book. And Peter, you're a campus pastor and I've been in college ministry for over a decade.
Yeah.
I would say that the number one thing that students want to talk to us about is the will of God for their future. Would you say that's fair?
Yes. Will of God for their future or their present, right?
Present. Yeah, right. I think that because college is a time where you're making a couple of decisions that have really big echoes through the rest of your life, the stakes just feel really high to get those decisions right. And so there's this sense of, well, what does God want? You know, does God have a plan or a will for my life? And it turns out that Paul says a couple of things about the will of God that are maybe a little surprising. Mm-hmm. So the first one is in chapter 4, verse 3, where Paul says, for this is the will of God.
Dude.
Well, that sounds helpful.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
What is it? <You're fine. laughs> For this is the will of God, your sanctification. Excuse me, what?
In my Bible, the last words on one page is, this is the will of God. So it's like, you read that and it's like, tell me what it is. I can't wait to hear it. You know, and then your eyes travel all the way up to the next page and it's just boom, right there, your sanctification.
Right. It isn't Mary Peggy or you're going to be an engineer.
Right.
It isn't the specific details of your future contingent on the decisions you're going to make. But we're not done because he does this again. This time it's a left branching sentence. So he says, rejoice always. Pray without ceasing, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. So what is the will of God for your life? Joy, spiritual devotion, thankfulness. I think that that's actually really important. And, you know, I think that students tend to think God has a plan for my life that I need to discover in order to have joy and thankfulness. If I get these decisions just right, if I get the right job and live in the right place and marry the right person, then essentially it takes the risk out of the equation. Like, I'm not responsible for those choices if they're actually choices God has already made and I have to discover. And so there's this real obsession about, like, what's the will of God? But that's not actually the way God works. You know, God has made us volitional creatures. God has made us co-creators. And so you get to actually, like, be a co-creator in your life. You get to make those choices and take responsibility for them.
Right.
The will of God for your life is continual growth towards the image of Christ, joy, thankfulness, in the context of the person you marry and the vocation you have and the church you join, and those more granular decisions that are really up to you. Now, there's a lot of wisdom seeking that goes into what's going to be a good fit for you, you know, what's going to lead to your thriving. But that's on the level of, here are some principles about how these things work out well that people who have been through this and the scriptures have. But then you get to make the choice. It's not the idea that God has this person picked out for you. And if you can just discover that, then you're going to be really happy.
Right. And you can imagine that if the will of God really was more about do this and don't do that, like Paul could have told the Thessalonians, actually, I think the will of God for you all is to buy some property. I don't know.
Right.
Buy some property, get an actual church in the downtown of Thessalonica and put it well positioned and raise this amount of money for it. Like, they could actually arrive there through what's stated as the will of God, which is their sanctification and joy and practices and thankfulness. You know, they might end up arriving there. I'm like, actually, we kind of think this is the next step for us, you know, based on wisdom. But what's laid out there is not those sort of plans that result from sanctification. What's laid out as God's will is for your sanctification. You know, like I've said about a million times, I pray the Lord's Prayer a lot these days. And there's the line of your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And I think we have this idea sometimes where it's like, oh gosh, that line kind of sucks to pray because it seems like God, your will, not my will. Like, even though I want what I want, I'm going to tell you that I want what you want for me. It's sort of someone has to win here, I guess, is the way we sometimes think about it. But really, if you look at the scriptures, God's will is for us to be sanctified. God's will is for us to be joyful and thankful. And God's will is for us to become the kinds of people who love him, love each other, love this world. And so that's what I pray. It's like, do your will in me. Make me that kind of person. I ask him to do it. And boy, do I find that freeing. And again, I don't mean to always go back to this is why we are the way we are, but it's why we have the mission that we do. Paul is saying that God's will is not that you make this decision or that decision. You become a certain kind of person. You know, you become someone who is, I guess, sanctified. And that's a sort of a loaded word we don't use a ton anymore. But that, yeah, you would be joyful and thankful and all these things. And I guess the logic is then if you're that kind of person, you will inherently be making wise decisions. But yeah, I find that super freeing.
And I think that it's also just practically true.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so how you experience your vocation will have a lot more to do with, are you a person who cultivates thankfulness rather than what job do you have? I think that your enjoyment of your vocation correlates more with your practices of thankfulness than with the actual like job you land. And your experience of marriage, in many cases, has more to do with how sanctified you are. Are you a person of temperance and repentance and forgiveness and joy than the actual person that you end up choosing? Now, preferably, you know, they would be the same thing. Like, you know, your marriage is going to be dependent on the sanctification of both partners. But like, it is those spiritual practices that make, you know, a 30-year marriage full of joy rather than finding your soulmate, which lasts about 18 months.
Yeah. So it's like if a student came to one of us and said, I'm dating this person, I'm struggling to know, like, do you think it's God's will for me to marry this person? It sounds like we would both say sort of along the lines of what we see Paul saying here is like people don't get told a ton in scriptures, do this or don't do that big decision thing. What they tend to get told is that what God wants for you is for you to be holy, for you to be sanctified and to, again, love him and love each other. And it's actually a bigger question of who are you becoming, not necessarily who are you going to marry.
To go down this rabbit hole a little bit, because students are interested in this, you become like the person you're marrying.
Yeah.
And so I think the way that God's will reflects on who you should marry is, you know, is this someone you want to become like? If you become like this person, are you becoming more like Jesus? Is really the question surrounding the will of God. As far as the, like, practical tactics of, is this person a good match for me? That's the realm of wisdom, not the will of God. That's the realm of, do my friends like me better when I'm around this person? Do my parents think this person is a good match for me because no one cares for me more or knows me better? Those sorts of questions come into play. If we look at how the phrase, the will of God, is used outside of Thessalonians, it's almost always used in this way. And in fact, the will of God is actually only shows up like 10 to 12 times in the scriptures. And it's always like this. It's always the will of God is for, you know, kind of your long-term development or the flourishing of the church or something along those lines rather than a specific plan for your life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a good excuse me what. I like that excuse me what. It's like you're expecting the will of God to be, you know, something more specific. And over and over again, we see that it's who are you becoming? God wants you to become a certain kind of person. That's his hope for you. Which, okay, if you go all the way back to the beginning, you know, and go back to why we were created to be, you know, co-rulers with him, to be in relationship with him and to be in relationship with each other and whole relationships both ways. It's like, that's what God wants for us, is for us to rule with him, to live into our created purpose. That's another way of saying everything we just said. But anyway, I think it's an exciting idea. I think it's thrilling. So thank you for that. Let's move to our next segment. Our next segment is I themed a theme. I should have sung it. I'm sorry, man.
I themed a theme. Yeah. Days gone by. It's my turn.
Yeah, it's your turn to sing it. Yeah, again, we got to come up with a little song, a little ditty. So I themed a theme, pretty obvious. All these letters have, you know, obviously different themes and different things pop up and come out. And so we just want to take some time to make sure we hit some of the big themes and some of the ones that pop out to us. And so Stanford, what theme did you theme as you read through this letter to the Thessalonians?
I think the theme pops.
I agree. It's tough to miss. Yeah.
It's the end of the world. Literally.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the end of the world. I feel like, you know, Peter, you and I, we're going to have to put on our sandwich boards. You know, the end is nigh, or the end is nigh-ish, I guess. I don't know. Like, it's right. Time for us to talk about the end times, which just, like, never seems, like, psychologically stable. Like, no one I know who is obsessed with, like, the end of the world is someone who's fun to be around.
Do you know many people obsessed with the end of the world?
Well, this was a big topic when I was younger.
I see.
The church kind of goes through theological fads. And when I was in college, there was a lot of talk about passages like this that, you know, that talked about the end of the world. And I think that, like, the big word here is eschatological. Eschaton means the end. And so anytime the Bible talks about kind of the end of the story, it's eschatological. And I think that the church kind of goes in waves of eschatological thinking where they tend to focus more on these passages that talk about how the story ends.
Yeah. My read right now is that we are in a low spot of thinking about eschatological things. I don't know if you feel that way.
I think that's true. And I'm not sure why. My wife had a little text chain with her Buddhist friend the other day when the sky looked purple or whatever it did after
the
fires.
Oh, yeah, when
it
was just smoky hell. Yeah.
Right. Her friend says, it looks like the apocalypse. And my wife texted back, you know, the sky is bad. Buddhist friend is using end time references. They have the kind of relationship where that would be fun. But I think that you don't want to be obsessed with the end of the story. But one of the big themes of the New Testament is that history does have an end. This whole story will have a climax and falling action. And the church has found it helpful to live with that template in mind.
Yeah.
That there is an end that could actually be at any time.
Yeah. So wait. So you said that the story will have a climax. From my understanding of the pieces of this story, the climax happened.
Yeah, right.
All
right.
The climax happened with Jesus coming and dying and rising again. And like, that's the moment that changed history. That's the moment that the kingdom is here, not fully, I suppose, the already but not yet theological idea. And I think I have a theory, I guess two theories of why we don't care. Well, not that we don't care, but that I don't hear people talking about this stuff right now, like in the college world or none of my friends seem to talk about it. I think there's part of it. Like I had a math teacher who was convinced, like in high school, that was convinced that we were going to see the end of the world in our lifetime. And it was the first time I'd ever heard anyone say that ever in my life, you know, thinking that, yeah, it could come. Jesus could come back in this time. And, you know, I kind of think it's a little bit like if something hasn't happened for this long, you just start to lose confidence that it's ever going to happen. Like I remember when Mason was like a week late, you know, we started thinking like, is this just the rest of our lives? Are you just going to be pregnant? Is he ever going to come? Like, and obviously it's ridiculous, but you just like leading up to the due date, all this anticipation, like it could be any day. And then the longer it goes on, you just start to convince yourself it's not happening.
All of our kids were late. And we literally had the same feeling. It's like, oh, yeah, I've been lied to.
Yeah, yeah. Or it's like, I imagine that many people like with the coronavirus right now.
Yes.
You know, it's like, hey, this has been a problem for how many months? I haven't gotten it. I probably won't. It's a fallacy, but it's easy to come into that thinking. And so I feel like this idea, which seemed pretty important to these Thessalonians and a lot of the early believers that Jesus might come back, it just hasn't happened for so long that I think either a lot of people either don't want to think about it or it's like, even if it does happen, it's probably a long, 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 long time from now. And so we don't even really have to worry about it.
Yeah. In our Zoom discussion after my last talk, one of the students brought up the Lindy effect, which is the idea that the longer something has been around, the longer it probably will be around. Mm-hmm. And I think that we apply the Lindy effect to history, right? Like that it's been 2,000 years since Jesus said he would come back. And so it probably will be a while longer. Whereas for them, it had been like 30 years since Jesus said he would come back. So it probably wouldn't be that long. You could apply the Lindy effect to eschatological thinking.
Which is funny because it's like the longer something has been around, which the something is that the nothing has happened.
That's right. That's right. But like objectively, the more time elapses between two fixed dates, the closer you are to the second fixed date. Right.
Right.
But I think that, you know, there is a psychologically stable place where we recognize that you know, this Netflix video has an end time. We don't know when it is, but we need to live like the story is coming to a close while we also live to leave a legacy for 8 generations. That's part of the healthy tension that I think is throughout all of these books, but really none more than First Thessalonians. That is the major tension in First Thessalonians.
So let me see if I can unwind that. You're saying that Paul is saying, and then extrapolating still to us in this day, because we're in the same technical state of the story that the Thessalonians were in, that, okay, so the climax has happened, and the story is going to end, and we are essentially in the falling action part of the story. So actually, now I'm not saying what you're saying. I'm saying what I'm saying, but based on what you're saying.
Right. That's good.
And so you need to live in the falling action as if the ending could come at any point. And I think what you mean by that is sort of take this seriously, like take your, do we say holiness?
The will of God.
Yeah, take the will of God seriously, because it could be any moment. And now I feel like I have my sandwich board on saying that the world's ending in 20 years, whatever.
Right.
But also, you don't know when it's going to come. And so the story could go on for generations. And so you also need to live in a way that doesn't live just for the ending, but lives for this slow and steady growth of faithfulness.
And I think that that's the tension that Paul is trying to pastor them into. It's interesting. There is this sense of being prepared for a sudden shift throughout the New Testament. Mm-hmm. The language in 1 Thessalonians, you know, that Jesus will come like a thief in the night. And I knew that that was used somewhere else. I thought it was the Gospels. It isn't. It's Revelation, which means that, you know, if Thessalonians is one of the earliest writings and Revelation is the latest, then this thief in the night idea, you know, permeates the New Testament. And like I was thinking about it in terms of, you know, FBC getting broken into.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, very appropriate.
Like, be prepared for a thief in the night is a pretty, like, compelling idea right now. Mm. Like, you want to have a certain amount of expectancy that you're part of a story that's directional, but also understand that we are also part of a story that is millennia long and could be millennia long. And so you want to build families and churches and communities that will last generations.
As I'm listening to you, I'm realizing that maybe one thing we're getting at in this sort of end times discussion from Thessalonians is sort of what's the point of Paul talking about this stuff?
Yeah.
And it seems if you just sort of read carefully that he's answering questions that they have.
Right.
So that's one thing. You know, it's not just he decides this is a good time to introduce this doctrine to the church. It's that.
That's right. Yeah.
The Thessalonians must have asked. You know, they must have some reason to be asking about this. I think we'll talk a little bit about some ways that other themes of the letter interact with that idea, things like work. But it sounds like, you know, a lot of times when people are interested in end times now, we are interested in, some people are interested in when it will happen, right? And this doesn't seem like Paul's interested in when. In fact, he says in the beginning of chapter 5, now concerning the times and the seasons, brothers, you have no need to have anything written to you. Meaning, you can't worry about it. That's not the question that we're dealing with. I guess then the question would be, what is he talking about? And it sounds like he's saying, this is how to live, knowing that the end is coming, but you don't quite know when it is. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Let's actually talk about what he actually says. He says that Jesus is going to return, and the dead are going to rise, and then you're going to like rise up and meet him in the clouds, right? Which, you know, people have interpreted various ways, and we're not going to take a position on that. And partially because I think anything that is as controversial as, you know, kind of end times theology is often that controversial because the scriptural data just don't constrain the question. You know, people go into rabbit holes of speculation instead of just saying, yeah, we don't really know everything that's going to happen. And that's okay.
And you've said in the past that you never want to be more specific than the scriptures.
Yeah, I don't want to believe something theologically that is more precise than the scriptures themselves. And I think that eschatology is in that realm, is that, you know, there are a lot of very precise timelines about what's going to happen. There's really only like 3 major sources of data in the New Testament. One is, you know, kind of in some of Jesus's late discourses. One of them is, you know, Jesus has these late discourses, you know, about the skies like blood and the temple being destroyed. And then the second is this Thessalonians material. And then you have Revelation. And so people pull these data together and form very specific future timelines. And they get funny names like, you know, premillennial, postmillennial, amillennial, dispensational. And I just think that most of those are more specific than the data themselves. And so what is Paul trying to tell them here? Well, he ends it by saying, encourage each other with these words. And so, like, I think this is a case where we really want to think about what was it like to be a Thessalonian, mm-hmm. that you were under Roman rule and you were proclaiming a different king than Roman rule, and you were getting your butt kicked. And Paul is saying, listen, this isn't the end of the story. Even if you die, even if your story ends here, this isn't the end of the story. Your investment in the truth will come to pass. You will be vindicated.
Again, it's contextual that what Paul's writing here is not true for everyone else, but it is hyper true for these Thessalonians. He is telling them these things not to give them necessarily a theological essay, but to say, hey, all the stuff you're going through and the hard times and all these things, like, I want this to encourage you that there is a future hope, that there is a future end to this story that turns out well for you, that God wins in this, in the end. And so, you know, it sort of strikes you, like, if you read 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, there is talk of judgment. There's talk of some people being, this language not used there, so don't take it too seriously, but sort of left out of this future. You know, there's people who are oppressing the Thessalonians who it seems like Paul is saying, these people will be judged. There's going to be a reckoning for them. And I think to our postmodern ears, here's that it's like, gosh, even though, yeah, maybe they're bad people or not bad people, even if they're doing bad things, like, I don't want something bad to happen to them, you know? And so even we have to read that, I think, through the lens of like, he's talking to the Thessalonians and he's talking about the stuff you're going through. God's not missing it. God's not blind to it. And there will be a future for you where you're free from this.
And I think that there's a lot of talk about justice and holding people to account right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's essentially what Paul is saying, is that, you know, we strive for human justice, but human justice will miss things that are truly just. And there is going to be a reckoning where justice in a pure form will be established, which honestly is good news and bad news, right? Because we are all, to various extents, people on the wrong side of justice, right? Like, we experience injustice, but we also perpetrate injustice, which is why the idea that there will be a reckoning is good news, but also the idea that there is an atoning sacrifice, there is atonement available for the injustices we have perpetrated, if we're penitent about them, is just the best news.
Yeah. So should we move on to the next segment? I think this conversation might spill over into the next segment a little bit.
Yeah, well, it's connected.
So this next segment is just something you can't get out of your head. We call it, I can't get it out of my head. I don't know if you have this experience, but when you're reading the text and then, you know, you sit with it for a little bit and then you're in a conversation with someone and it's like one particular thing keeps popping up. You know, it's just like, I feel like sometimes when I'm reading the scriptures, I mention the same text four or five times or said four or five different conversations, but it's always the same thing. It's like the one thing that sort of just sticks there and lodges in my mind that I can't stop thinking about. And so what is it for you, Stanford, that you just can't get out of your head?
There's a juxtaposition between these kind of wild eschatological pictures of speculation about the return of Jesus and then these very like earthy and super practical ideas about how to live life. Like, so just before he gets into the section about the coming of the Lord and the day of the Lord, Paul says this. He says, you yourselves have been taught by God to love one another. Do this more and more, and aspire to live quietly and mind your own affairs and to work with your hands as we have instructed you. That's Paul's recommendation for how to live in light of the fact that history is going to end.
Hmm.
That seems like a non sequitur.
Totally.
There's real dissonance there.
So you said that this passage comes right after or right before the day of the Lord?
Right before.
Right before. And so in the Old Testament, there are these times when they're longing for the day of the Lord where God finally rescues his people and sets things right. And that sort of becomes shorthand for this ultimate day where God's going to finally ultimately do this. And that's what it seems like Paul's talking about, sort of the ending date of history as we know it now. And so you're saying that in light of that massive cosmic reality, the way to live is not to pack your go bag and just start watching the clock. The way to live is to go to work, set your alarm clock for your normal time, pack your lunch, go to work, go home, do normal life.
Love your family and commit to an affectionate care for your local church.
Yeah.
It seems incongruous, right? That you have this like wild cosmic reality and the practical application is set your alarm clock and do your stuff.
Yeah.
This has bugged me since the very beginning of my Christian faith. We believe in these wild cosmic realities that should reorder our lives, that we have the ability to be in relationship with the creator of the universe, and that creator of the universe came and you know, invaded the very thing that God created in the person of Christ, that who can be known through the Holy Spirit. And that's a message that everyone has access to and that we get to share, and that we get to be agents of justice in the world. You know, like James calls us to like real material care of other people. Oh, and by the way, God raised from the dead and will come again. And that's going to be pretty dramatic. These are some pretty like wild ideas. So how do you like raise a family and hold a job and do these really gritty things day-to-day life in light of these like wild truths that are underlying the universe? Like, how is that even psychologically stable?
And do you mean by that, like, if you're interacting with these huge cosmic ideas on that sort of level, like, how do you ever have any focus for the sort of more mundane, granular?
Right. How is this other stuff not just stuff that you do because you have to do, but you don't really love it, right?
Or I see.
How can you justify any other life than full-time ministry? Questions like that. You know, one of the top five influential books in my life is Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Ethics. Bonhoeffer is kind of a famous German theologian from World War II. And if you say German theologian from World War II, you start to get really super nervous, right? And yeah, he is controversial, right? But he's controversial in the opposite way. He was involved in a plot to kill Hitler and ended up getting executed for it. And so he spent the second half of World War II in jail, and he smuggled out this manuscript little by little and didn't get to finish it. So there are parts of this manuscript where, you know, chapters just end. It's disconcerting. But there are a number of things in that book that changed my life. One of those things is, you know, he talks about the theology of the penultimate. And so there are ultimate things. And then there's this other layer of things that aren't ultimate things that we could kind of discount and say, well, you know, work and, you know, family life and, you know, the grittier things of life, maybe those things aren't as important. But he talks about like the theology of the penultimate and how, you know, creation ennobles these things and gives them value. And Paul really affirms that in this passage. He says, yeah, in light of the fact that the world is going to end, you know what matters? Your sanctification. And you know how that plays out? He talks specifically about sexual ethics, which in this context is faithfulness to a family. He talks about, you know, going to work and being part of your community, being part of the secular community of the city, but also, you know, really investing in affection for your church.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. The word penultimate is one of the words that I actually remember being on a vocab test.
Oh, really? A lot of people get it wrong. They think there's ultimate and then there's penultimate, which is even more ultimate, but it's not. It's like less ultimate.
Yeah. I think it's funny. Like, there's a few words where like, I remember when I purchased them, essentially. Like, I remember when I put them in my pocket for the rest of my life. And so penultimate just means before the ultimate.
Yeah.
Essentially. Like second to last.
Yeah, right.
But so then, yeah, you can really see, if I'm hearing you right, that because sometimes when you're reading these letters in Paul, like maybe jumps from topic to topic, they seem disconnected. But really, if you see these two things we just talked about, so the end times cosmic things, and then these really granular things about hard work, about sexual immorality and sanctification, they sort of seem like these are totally two different scales. But when you, I guess when you put them together, they make sense in light of each other. Even if it's sort of incongruous, even if it's like, and I wonder if that's part of it. I wonder if Paul's talking about this because maybe he senses, hey, you guys are living in a way only for the end of the world. You're not going to work and putting in the time like this. You are the one packing your bag, just waiting for the end to come. And you can imagine, like, you know, it's like a Friday at 4 o'clock. How hard are you working a Friday at 4 o'clock when you have an hour left of the work week? It's like, I can see the end coming. Is this really when I'm going to start doing hard work? No. Not at all, you know? And so he's like, hey, I might sense, and I don't know, this is a theory, but like, I might sense that you all see that you feel like right now for you, it's Friday at 4 o'clock. And so why put in the time? But he's like, look at what we did when we were with you. We worked so hard. We didn't ask for any money from you. We could bless ourselves and others with what we were able to do. And that's how I want you to live. Yes, the end might be coming, but you need to live as if you have plenty of time of faithfulness left in your life.
That's right. And I think that what he's saying is that if the end does come, like what you'll be evaluated on is how you lived your ordinary life. Not were you like some sort of superstar like Paul, which we can argue if that is even the way to evaluate things. But you know, were you faithful? Were you faithful to your family, to your church, to the people who invest in your time and labor? Mm-hmm. Those are the commitments of faithfulness that form kind of the core of God's will for your life.
There's another, sorry for the sports metaphors. It's just the things that come up to my mind. But
you know, I love them.
I know. It's just when you do use them too much, it can be much. But there's this concept in sports of the trap game. And the trap game happens when in between two big games. So say, I don't know, say the Warriors are playing the Lakers one game, and then they play like the Timberwolves, who, let's be honest, not much of a problem. And then they're playing the, let's say, the Clippers or someone else that's awesome, you know? And so you get really excited for the Lakers game. Maybe you even win that game. And then you sort of assume, well, we're going to take care of the Timberwolves. Let's prepare for the Clippers game. And in the meantime, you're not preparing for that Timberwolves game. And so you are not prepared. They are super prepared. And you lose the trap game. You're thinking, oh, these two really important games are happening, but there's a game in between that you should win, but because it's sandwiched between these two great things, you overlook it and you lose. And so if those two great things are, hey, Jesus has come and you've become a Christian, you have this brand new life, and the end is coming, like, you got to make sure you prepare for the Timberwolves.
You know, most of your life will be Timberwolves. I actually love the idea of the trap game because I think it's real. I've explained the principle of the trap game to a team of competitive 9-year-old soccer players because it's a thing. They need to learn not only about soccer, but about life. And also because teams that I played on when I was in high school, we were mediocre. But I tell you what, we made hay off of being the trap game. So I knew how powerful that was from the other side. The way that people talk about doing the trap game well is taking care of business. Right? Like, you got to go into Minnesota and take care of business. That's just what Paul's saying here. Is Paul saying, like, yeah, this amazing thing just happened and this amazing thing is going to happen. But right now, you need to take care of business. And that means spiritual growth, affectionate connection to a community, family faithfulness, and work, like vocational faithfulness.
Are you getting the family faithfulness from the sexual immorality?
I am. Yeah. Because I mean, among college students, when we talk about sexual ethics, we talk about, like, you know, hey, while you're dating, try to keep your pants up, right? Like, we're talking about, like, pre-marriage sexual ethics, which are important and which we talk about a lot. But, you know, most of the Bible's focus on sexual ethics is keeping families together. And so one of the reasons why it's really important and wise to practice Christian sexual ethic before you're married is because it sets the patterns for the really critical, you know, purpose of sexual morality and sex itself, which is to build family faithfulness. The family is the, like, fundamental unit of the church, which is God's plan for the world.
Totally. I get that. That all makes sense. It doesn't jump off the page.
Right. That's right.
Your reader doesn't jump off the page. And there's other things that jump off the page if you read the actual text. And I'll read part of it. And this might be a bad idea because we might not have time to talk about all of it. But so it says that, you know, for this is the will of God, your sanctification. We talked about that. But then after the sanctification is a colon, and so it's going to define sanctification, essentially. It says that you abstain from sexual immorality, that each one of you know how to control his or her own body in holiness and honor, not in the passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God, that no one transgress and wrong his brother in this matter, because the Lord is an avenger in all these things, as we told you beforehand and solemnly warned you. And so, okay, so...
Excuse me, what?
excuse me, what? Yeah.
Right.
Just an observation that a lot of times when we talk about sexual ethics, something that you hear is like Christians should make less of a deal about sexual ethics. And we've talked about it too much, which could, like, very well could be true. You know, talked about it too much and... Or we're putting too much emphasis on this one sin or one area of holiness. But what's interesting is that this is the only thing Paul mentions in terms of sanctification right here, which I don't think means it's the only thing he thinks is a matter of sanctification. But this is not a list of things like he presents in other letters. Like, this is just, he's saying your sanctification, I guess for you, Thessalonians, is to abstain from sexual immorality. And, you know, as I'm talking, this is sort of stream of consciousness, but, you know, these people, especially the Gentile ones who crossed over and became followers of Jesus, like, they were in this, the pagan Roman world where, you know, sex worship is going to temples and worshiping via sex with, you know, temple prostitutes is a real thing. And so The idea of sexual immorality there might not be the same thing as, you know, you're dating someone, make sure you draw nice boundaries. But it's, hey, there's this whole way of life that you've left that was built around sex and worship tied together. And what seems like he's saying is, like, you're no longer that person. You're living a new life. And so your sanctification means to flee from that which you used to be. So, you know, there could be that. But I don't know. Do you have any thoughts just maybe before we wrap up? I don't know why we're wrapping up with this, but I just...
I have a million thoughts. We were going to talk about this at the fall retreat, right? And we are not having a fall retreat. But to kind of bring it full circle, if you think about those two will of God passages, one of them is negative and one of them is positive, right? Paul says the will of God is your sanctification. And then he says, you know, avoid sexual immorality, and then doubles down on it.
Right.
And then the other one is positive. Paul always has this put off the things that are unhealthy and put on the things that are healthy. And so then he says the will of God is joy, spiritual practices, and circumstance neutral thankfulness, mm-hmm. circumstance agnostic thankfulness. And so,
which, by the way, I'm so sorry, I'm going to interrupt you so fast. But that right there, if you guys all remember a week ago when we talked about James on Tuesday night, that circumstance neutral thankfulness could be a synonym for steadfastness.
That's right.
So that's right. The thing that happens through trials. So anyway, just to build some continuity.
So Paul always has this idea of, you know, moving forward in the Christian story involves putting things off and putting things on. And when he talks about putting things off, it's almost always a list. And these lists are hilarious because it's things like orgies and obeying your parents, right? Like honoring your parents and orgies show up in the same list, right? Sometimes. But here, he doesn't go into a list. And it makes me think that there's something particular about the people coming from Roman religions who are forming this church, where they need this advice in particular. But I think that our culture is extremely sexualized. And if Paul was writing a letter to our culture, that he would have like three super long Paul sentences about sexual morality. The reason that I talk about it as family building is that, you know, he's not just a buzzkill. Like, you know, the Christian sexual ethic is purposeful. It's functional. It's about building a multi-decadal relationship, which is the context for launching another generation, right? And so it's not just these arbitrary rules that emerge out of, you know, Old Testament Levitical law. It's actually the way that God builds his kingdom. And so we will talk at some point about, you know, healthy boundaries for Christian dating relationships, because that does fall under this category. The last thing I'll say is that, excuse me, what? Because God is an avenger, we have another category that is like, hey, can I have an eraser?
Right.
There might be some verses that we're uncomfortable with that would want to erase. And because we've been in these letters, I've been reading them in sequence, and I'm starting to see some themes. And I find that Paul and the other authors of letters, including James and Peter, have a kind of whole taxonomy of words that they use for God's displeasure about things that we do that are rebellion against the kingdom. They start with words that I'm very comfortable with, like discipline, right? Like God disciplines us so that we will grow, right? Like so that we will move forward. And other words that I'm really comfortable with, like justice. And then it gets into judgment, but judgment is really just justice that is exerted.
Right.
But then there's also words like wrath and even this avenger word, where there is this kind of panoply of words that Paul uses to say that, you know, God is morally serious. God loves you with an unconditional, lavish, unbelievable love, but is also morally serious and wants you to grow, because God's will for your life is sanctification, is, you know, growing in the image of Christ.
That all makes sense. It can be hard to read, but at the very least, it seems like a principle to take away is not that sexual ethics are the only thing. But what we know from anecdotal evidence, if you look at the news and what types of scandals happen all the time, it's like this part of life has an outsized impact on our life. Maybe we're venturing into realm of things where it's like, you know, I just stated that and I don't have any time to prove it. But I mean, it's anecdotal.
Well, I would end with this. Sexual ethics is something you want to get right, as far as like the, you know, six or seven things in your life that you kind of want to think carefully about, be wise, and just get right. This is one of those things.
Yeah. Well, I think it's quarantine corner time. What do you think?
Yeah, let's do it.
Quarantine corner, baby. Okay, so this is where we give you all sorts of recommendations to fill your time and give you joy during pandemic playtime. So I'm going to go first. And my quarantine corner is a prop party.
Oh, amazing.
Okay, that's my quarantine corner, is have a prop party. So what's a prop party, you may ask? I don't know if you know this, Stanford, but there is an election coming.
Oh my goodness. I spent 5 hours on my ballot. Not on the first box. The first box is easy. The other boxes, yeah. I'm up to 5 hours of time invested on propositions and school boards and things like that.
See, this is perfect.
I wish that I had gone to a prop party.
Yeah, dude. Okay, so our Bible study, this is a shout to Pearl Corsetto, who initially had the idea, I think in 2018 or maybe 2016. I don't remember. But the idea was like, you know, we have people in our Bible study. And so She was like, hey, why don't we all take a prop? One of us will take a prop and then we'll make a teensy little PowerPoint presentation, give a little, here's what it is, here's the fiscal impact, here's what it means if we vote yes, here's what it means if we vote no. And so basically what we're doing is we're putting those 5 hours that you just talked about. We're saying we're going to put 5 hours as a group into this, but as individuals, we're putting way less time. So then we all get together and we present our little proposition. And so here's the beauty of it. One, it's just fun. It's like, we're making a difference. You know, we're doing it. We're getting involved, which is great. It feels good. But here's the other thing. The thing about voting that sucks is that for me is that I just feel dumb. Like, I don't feel like I'm a dumb person, but when I try to read through these things, I'm like, I couldn't be dumber. I don't understand most of these nouns, you know, I don't understand what they are. And so every time the next person, you know, they introduce the prop, here's Prop 16, here's what it means, it's tax assessments. And I'm like, all those words mean nothing to me at the very beginning. But then as it progresses, I don't feel it happening to me, but I am inculcating what the proposition is about. And I do feel like I sort of understand it. So the reason I have a prop party is one, that it's fun. Two, you don't have to do the research on every single prop. You outsource a lot of that and you end up kind of getting it. And you sort of know, yeah, I want to vote no. I want to vote yes, which feels good because I've walked into the ballot box and I've been like, I've never heard of this before. And I'm reading the little description on the ballot box. I am the definition of an uninformed voter, which all I'm saying is that that doesn't feel good.
Yeah. And some of these propositions, you can't vote based on what's in there. Like one of them says, we will make certain crimes into felonies. Well, which crimes? Yeah. Right? Like if you don't know which crimes, you can't vote on that.
Right.
One of these propositions is 50 pages long.
Dude, yeah. Yeah. Super long and super confusing.
Super confusing. And so small group can offload some of that. The other thing is that if we all just spent like 10% of the time that we spend thinking about the national election on these things that really do matter, I think that we'd just be more psychologically healthy and a better governed place.
Totally, totally. And so I recommend to all of you listening to gather some of your people and put up the props and get enough that maybe you only have to do one. I did Prop 18, which, if I'm honest, was the easiest one. It was the 17-year-olds can vote in the next primary or in the next general election.
It's the easiest one to understand, at least.
Yeah, easiest one to understand, at least. So anyway, I did that one. You might even get that one where you got to do a little bit of research. It sort of makes sense. The categories make sense. And anyway, so it was a joy. And so then you just go to the ballot box and you just tick, 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 tick. I made all these decisions already. And so that's my recommendation. Have a prop party.
All right, that's great. My quarantine corner is human foosball.
Yeah.
Human foosball.
So I coach soccer, as a lot of people know. And I am currently coaching soccer, although in the state of California, you're not allowed to have any contact, which means that a lot of people are going to Arizona play tournaments, but that's a different thing.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah. Like the Davis Club is going to Arizona to play tournaments. There was a big article about it. There's like an economic boom in Arizona from California sports teams going to play.
Oh, my gosh.
Hey, we follow the law plan. That's part of my like Christian discipline, but we want to train. And so, you know, we can do a lot of skills, but the tactics are hard to teach without like live play. And so what we've done is we've developed this kind of human foosball system, which is really just a zonal scrimmage, but you like each person gets their own space, almost like they're like one of the plastic foosball players that can move laterally.
Is it like a circle? Everyone has their own little circle they can be in?
No, it's a grid.
Oh.
And so within the grid, you have a portion and then it really trains through passes. And then we added outside lanes so that players could leave their grid and go in the outside lane if there's no one in it. So it keeps things distant. They were calling it socially distant soccer because that's nicely alliterated. But I don't really like socially distanced. I don't want to be socially distanced. I want to be physically distanced. And so I'm calling it physically distanced football because I'm also a purist. But you know, I did it with my like eight-year-old boys. It's very difficult to teach them tactics. But they were like making overlapping runs into these outside lanes, keeping their distance. Like, there was some sort of modern Manfield outside wingback. And so we're actually thinking that it teaches the principles well enough that we might actually do some of this when we go back to normal times. And here's why. Is because I think that to learn something as free as making runs in soccer, you have to learn it in the context of structure. Freedom always emerges from structure. You learn it in a structured setting, and then you learn to start doing themes on variations. And so I think there's actually a spiritual principle here is that, you know, freedom emerges from structure, but that's free.
You're unbelievable. The way you start with the phrase human foosball, and then you end up with this profound spiritual principle. And along the way, I'm like, I didn't know I was learning a lesson here. You know, I think I'm going for this mental image of people kicking their legs about. And then I end up with, yeah, you're right. You're right. I think freedom's just freedom and free from constraint. But no, it makes sense. Need structure for freedom. Unbelievable. All right, that's it for us. If you want to have a prop party or play some human foosball, you can thank us for it later. See you next week. All right, that's it for the podcast. Thank yous are in order to Stanford for his usual friendship and faithfulness, as well as to Kyle Jung and Josh Paskey for giving us the music of Your Pod and Your Staff. Please remember us when you are famous. Thanks to Heidi Rudvogts for your magical editing touches. And stay tuned. Next week, we have a very special beloved guest as we open up Paul's letter to the church in Galatia. But to close College Life, let me remind you that we love you even more than Wednesday Babcock slays the skateboard. We'll see you next week.